Blog Talk Radio. How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps, and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. See you there.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Patients with COVID-19 should not be given the antiviral drug remdesivir, the UN World Health Organization WHO has said. According to data from the WHO-led Global Solidarity Trial, there was no evidence that remdesivir had any important effect on people dying or reduced the need for ventilation or speeded up the time it took for them to get better. Nonetheless, WHO said that there was no proof that the antiviral had no benefit at all and stressed that further trials should continue into whether the drug might be useful for more vulnerable patients. Here's Dr. Janet Diaz, Head of Clinical Care at WHO, speaking in Geneva.
We recommend a conditional recommendation, so I want to highlight that it's a conditional recommendation, against the use of remdesivir in hospitalized patients with COVID-19, regardless of disease severity. This did not prove that remdesivir does not have a benefit at all. You know, is there a subgroup that may benefit more, such as severe patients versus critical patients? Is there a timing in disease that may benefit more, such as early versus late?
Latest data from WHO indicates that 8 in 10 people infected with COVID report mild symptoms, while around 5% become critically ill. There are also reports of more persistent, longer-term symptoms, WHO said. More than 30,000 people have now fled Ethiopia's Tigray region to Sudan in just 2 weeks amid ongoing fighting, and the UN says that it is planning for as many as 200,000 to arrive. In an appeal for $200 million, UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that about 45% of refugees were children under 18. Most people left their homes quickly and with nothing, although some had brought their animals, belongings and harvest, said UNICEF's Sudan representative, Abdullah Fadil. People were scared. We saw panic and fear in the eyes of many children, he told journalists, especially those who might have witnessed artillery fire or airplanes dropping bombs, in reference to fighting between Ethiopian government and Tigray regional forces. Sudan already hosts more than 1.2 million refugees and 2 million internally displaced people. UN aid agencies have said that the number of people arriving in the country, some 4,000 to 5,000 a day, is unsustainable and potentially has serious repercussions for the whole region. To northwest Syria finally, where the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, has expressed alarm at disturbing reports of unlawful killings by de facto authorities and the continued detention of civilians, including humanitarian workers. OHCHR spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani also appealed for the release of a 28-year-old woman, Noor Al-Shallow, a humanitarian and media worker. She was detained by non-state group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in recent days. It confirmed that it was holding her on so-called moral and criminal charges. Ms. Shamdasani said that her family has not had any contact with her and that she may be at risk of execution. Noor Al-Shallow's case is among many others that the UN office has documented of individuals detained or abducted and executed in the northwest and other parts of Syria over the past year. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network, your podcast on reprogramming our economies to work for all of us. I'm your producer and host, Naomi Fowler, and I'm joined each month by John Christensen. Coming up later.
Unfortunately, your country and America is in many ways assisting this kind of corrupt behavior. This is what I can't tolerate anymore, the lies. This cannot continue.
We look at the terrible explosion in Beirut in the summer 2020. The story of tracing those responsible reveals everything that's wrong with our world. This month, two things in particular to look out for. The Tax Justice Network's releasing a new report on the state of tax justice in 2020. We'll reveal for the first time how much each country in the world is losing to international corporate tax abuse and private tax evasion. One nurse's yearly salary is lost every second to a tax haven. Check out the report and have a look at your country's losses on our website, www.taxjustice.net. And there's a great new book out called Bear Markets and Beyond, a bestiary of business terms. You've heard of black swan events. What about the grey swan? Vulture investors you know, but how about dragon bonds, bunny markets and porcupine provision? Welcome to this jungle. It's full of beautiful illustrations and short, witty explainers. Well worth a look. Here's author Druti Shah.
The intent of the book is to help with financial literacy, to make sure that the world of business, the world of economics is demystified, but in a fun way. So it's suitable for four-year-olds all the way up to 110-year-olds. There's a lot of disinformation, misinformation, like debunking going on in the book as well. You can go and see what a bear market is, because bear markets and bull markets are being discussed quite a lot right now, especially in this post-COVID economy terms that we're in. Money matters affect everybody. You don't want to be scared. And that's what the whole point of the book is.
It's published by Pavilion Books. It's a brilliant thing. Okay, so we're going to talk to John Christensen now of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, this month Joe Biden has won the US elections. That's a win he's probably going to have to prise out of Trump's cold, dead hands by the looks of it. It's not really hard, is it, for Joe Biden to look like a serious president when it comes to policy compared to the current administration? And there's so much the Biden administration really needs to do. What does this mean for tax justice and economic policies? We don't yet know what the balance of power is going to be in the all-important Senate yet, do we? One of the surprisingly easier ones for Biden could actually be the potential to tackle monopoly power, because there is cross-party support there. What do you think? Do you agree?
Well, yes. I mean, in so many respects, this is potentially a massive turning point for the United States. Recent history, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, which really provided nothing more than a sugar rush to the US economy, which was already booming at that time, after successive waves of economic stimulus from the Fed from 2010 onwards. But the big winners from the tax changes have been the billionaire class, and they've become massively richer as a result of the stock market boom. And of course, big corporations have also done extremely well. Their profits have shot up.
Yeah, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris tweeted after their election win, quote, Joe Biden and I will eliminate the Trump tax cuts for the biggest corporations and super wealthy, then get back to work building an economy that works for working families.
Yes, I mean, if you look at what's happened in terms of corporation tax, for example, the headline rate of corporation tax was cut by that act from 35% to 21%, though we must always bear in mind that most big corporations didn't pay anything like that rate. But those cuts have had a dramatic impact on the federal tax receipts. Despite booming profits, corporate tax receipts have fallen from 9% of total tax revenues in 2017 to 6.6% in 2019. That's close to a 30% fall in just 2 years, which means that the incoming Biden presidency will be inheriting yet another structural deficit of revenue over expenditure, and the gap between rich and poor people can only get even wider unless there's massive transformation across the board. And that means that Joe Biden and his team must address the colossal power of the corporate world, which after decades of mergers and acquisitions has become super concentrated into the hands of monopoly corporations in virtually all sectors. And that ranges from pharmaceuticals to meat packing, from media ownership to online data collection and advertising. Now, as you say, there is bipartisan support for taking action to improve market quality and push back against dominating monopoly companies. And there's a good reason for this cross-party support. If you look at the agriculture sector, for example, which is kind of the heart of the American dream, you'll find swathes of farmers in the Midwest being forced out of business by the dominance of just one or two companies, which totally control the meat packing and wholesale sector, which might well provide consumers with cheaper products at the checkout, but this is at the expense of deteriorating contractual provisions for the farmers, and that leads to cost cutting, which has negative impacts on environmental protection, on worker protection, and on food quality generally. And this is all due to the dominant market power of the monopolist companies which control the industry. And when you factor in the other costs, for example, the ways in which super large companies are able to avoid paying tax in the states, and they're chasing subsidies, and they're using their political weight to lobby for weaker protections and lower standards, and you can see why there's this need to tackle monopolies, and that ranks alongside all the other huge priorities facing the incoming administration, including climate crisis and tackling inequality and restoring trust in democracy.
Yeah, and that's not just the United States that suffers from this monopoly power problem, is it?
Yeah, and it's interesting that the debate around concentrated corporate power is raging in the United States, but it's not raging in other parts of the world. It's not raging, for example, in Europe. Whilst in the United States, we can see that measures are now actively being pursued in the Congress, and as you said, with bipartisan support, we really don't see anything happening on a similar level in Europe, where the competition authorities continue to think that monopolies are okay, provided they bring lower prices to consumers. And there's little attention being paid to, you know, the way in which monopolies are using their power to squeeze suppliers, to squeeze workers' conditions, to harm environmental protections and so on. So in many respects, this should be a wake-up call for civil society in Europe to start paying attention to these matters and perhaps look to what's happening in the United States.
So there's easier stuff, there's harder stuff for the Biden administration to pass. Let's talk about corruption, because we've heard lots of politicians claiming they're going to tackle corruption. I mean, remember the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown proclaiming the end of tax havens. President-elect Biden has for a while been explicitly supportive of beneficial ownership transparency, so no secretive owners of companies. And he's been supportive of transparency in real estate, for example. He's quite keen as well to strengthen judicial independence, which is a good thing. And what really stands out to me is that he said, and I'm quoting, "I will also take steps to tackle the self-dealing conflicts of interest, dark money and rank corruption that are serving narrow private or foreign agendas and undermining our democracy. That starts by fighting for a constitutional amendment to completely eliminate private dollars from federal elections." Wow.
Yeah, wow. And so important, because, you know, if you just look at what's happened in the course of the US elections this time round, I think it's fair to say that the entire world has been reeling in horror at the speed with which the confidence in democracy in the United States has been undermined. By the way, I don't think that just applies to the United States. I think it applies equally to Brazil, to Britain, to Hungary, to Italy, Poland. Several other countries could be added to that list. And I think it's recognised that these dark money flows are threatening the core institutes of democracy to the extent that we really should regard them as national and international security threats. And I think that the incoming Biden administration recognises this and recognises that confidence in democracy needs to be restored. And they'll be working urgently to restore confidence, not just in democracy, but also in the independence of the media and the independence of the judiciary, and against widespread public perceptions that democracy has been corrupted by big players who can game the system to their personal advantage, leaving the honest Joes and Josephines to suffer. So there's a lot that needs to be done. And here are a few of the measures that I think might help restore public confidence in both the state and in the judiciary. First, the United States can resume what I think was its previous leadership position by taking immediate measures to strengthen corporate transparency and reduce dark money flows into politics, banning anonymous shell companies in every state in the United States and requiring full disclosure of information that is ownership information. That's just the start. I think the United States also needs to re-engage with its partners in Europe and in other democracies and push for greater cooperation with information sharing between national authorities. For example, they can sign up to the Common Reporting Standard for Automatic Information Exchange, which until now they haven't signed up for. That wasn't the Trump administration that didn't sign up. It was the Obama administration that didn't sign up to the Common Reporting Standard. But now is the moment to do that. Now, second, what I used to think of the United States Internal Revenue Services as providing the gold standard for tax authorities around the world, the cuts of recent years to the Internal Revenue Services have massively eroded capacity and capability. They've just lost too many of their really capable staff. And that especially applies to the specialized units set up to tackle tax cheating by the super rich people and by large corporations. We all know that this didn't happen by accident. The rich and powerful have been lobbying for cuts to the Internal Revenue Service for decades. And we as tax justice campaigners need to push hard for revenue authorities to be properly funded and totally rejuvenated. Now, third, we'd like to see the United States take a more positive role more generally at the United Nations, especially in reinvigorating the United Nations efforts to create a new set of rules for taxing multinational companies on the basis of unitary taxation, and also work with UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, to set new rules for corporate behavior. Now, of course, there are loads of other measures which we'd love to see the incoming administration push for. Wealth taxes, for example, financial transaction tax. They could perhaps follow Britain's lead in applying unexplained wealth orders to all the assets held by oligarchs in the United States. And more generally, it would be great to see the US working in tandem with the rest of the world to put an end for once and for all to the secrecy jurisdictions, which represent such a threat to democracy and international security.
Briefly, the fact that 70 million odd US Americans did actually vote for Trump, despite knowing he hadn't paid his taxes for many years, among many other things, what does it say about the permissibility of corruption in the US today? I mean, Biden's appeal to decency didn't convince so many millions of voters. And I mean, on the one hand, you can see there's been so many generations of polished politicians who've changed very little for ordinary people for far too long. We have the corporate capture of information, of course, but in the end, the old sort of die-hard attitudes about tax cuts boosting growth and misrepresentation of the centrality of tax and economics, it still really seems to connect with people, doesn't it?
Yes, it does seem to connect with people. And it's been tragic watching how people have been duped. There's no other word. They've been duped by all the lies and the false facts being circulated by lobbyists and special interests. But this goes back a long, long way, long before President Trump. Part of the problem lies with all the bogus think tanks in Washington and the for-hire economists sponsored by big businesses. You pick the example of how tax cuts stimulate economic growth. That's just such a nonsense. It's been disproved, and not just for years, but for decades. There's been no evidence to support that assertion. So one of the major challenges facing the incoming president lies with resetting public awareness of how economies really work and helping people to understand that the program that's run the US economy for the last half century or so, that is the program of tax cuts for the rich and rolling back the states and cutting regulations and privatizing public assets, that program has turned a few millionaires into billionaires, but it has left the vast majority of people massively worse off.
Thanks, John. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature, Secrecy, Key. pills. Governments around the world continue to allow the real owners of companies to hide their identities. Those people know if they break the law or end up hurting anyone, they're unlikely to face justice in the courts. This month, we look at the terrible events on August the 4th, 2020, in Beirut, Lebanon.
لا 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 عم بيجيبون بس مش عم فينا نستقبلهم عم بيعالجون برا بالطريق عم بيعالجون على الطريق المستشفى كله مكسر
شوفوا شو عم بيصير شوفوا
You're hearing the terrible sounds of one of the largest non-nuclear explosions ever recorded. It killed more than 200 people, injured many thousands, and made 300,000 people homeless. People as far away as Cyprus heard this blast of nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate igniting. It had been left sitting in a warehouse in Beirut's port for more than 6 years. It was obviously dangerous, but there it was anyway. The story of tracing those responsible tells us everything that's wrong with our world.
I remember the explosion happened on the 4th of August. And I wrote an email to my boss. I said, there's a big story here.
This is Rana Sabag of the OCCRP, the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. She's also founder of the Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism. The OCCRP oversaw a huge collaboration on the Beirut explosion with journalists across the world in many languages. There are some terrible personal stories.
We did a very sad story on a silo worker, you know, the silo, the grain silo. That worker had taken refuge in that silo during the war in Lebanon, the civil war, for 20 years. And he was always worried about his family that lived in a flat nearby. And the family found out that the silo that protected him during the civil war ended up to be his graveyard. So the guy died there.
As well as personal tragedies like these, this was a national tragedy for a population that's endured long years of civil war and economic trauma. Lebanon's president had even been warned of the danger by the security services.
The successive ministers of public works under whom the port lies, the successive security people, the successive prime ministers and the president of Lebanon, definitely these people should all be sued for negligence at least.
Right. And this story goes far beyond the national context in terms of Lebanon itself. Bad management at the port, a ship that brought the explosives that wasn't really seaworthy. It goes beyond low accountability nationally, doesn't it?
Yeah, we basically exposed the true owner of the vessel, the complicated web of players and how they were hiding under this enormous global network of safe havens and company registrations and maritime registrations and different countries using different flags. Every story we are looking at today in the Arab world will have a connection to one of those safe havens. And God knows, how can you find the real owners if every jurisdiction says, sorry, we can't give out any data helping people that should be exposed?
Journalists and investigators of all kinds come up against this same wall of secrecy worldwide. With this story, there's a huge number of countries involved in complicated ownership structures and transactions. The OCCRP discovered the ammonium nitrate was purchased from the country of Georgia by an explosives factory in Mozambique that produces commercial explosives. It's also part of a network of companies that's previously been investigated for weapons trafficking and explosives violations. Now, stay with me. That factory bought the ammonium nitrates through a UK-based company with links to Ukraine. At the time the UK company acted on behalf of the Mozambicans, it reported no official business activity to UK authorities, and it's remained dormant ever since. When it comes to the ship that carried the ammonium nitrates, there's a whole lot of untangling that OCCRP did to work out who the owner actually was. The ship was supposed to just be calling in at the port in Beirut to collect more cargo before setting off again, but it was in such poor condition it never left the port. It was impounded and it eventually sank. It's still there under the water. The British registered company started a process to claim the cargo of explosives that were taken out and left in the warehouse, but then abandoned it. The Mozambican factory never tried to directly claim the explosives.
There is a systemic failure that doesn't start or end in Lebanon, but crosses the world and intersects with a whole number of different industries.
This is Tom Townsend of Open Ownership.
The kind of issue around shipping and ownership around ships, actually that becomes a transnational issue, but of course also becomes an issue that takes place in ungoverned spaces within the law of the high seas. In this case, the ships that can do business in those spaces, which themselves are hidden behind, as currently conceived, entirely legitimate opacity and flags of convenience, that is being able to register a ship in a country of choice that perhaps has a lax regulatory regime or will allow you to sort of invest less in safety or staff protection and so on and so forth. It is not okay anymore in 2020 to own a business, to own a ship that you have deliberately hidden the ownership of through hugely complicated structures to either avoid tax or minimize your tax liability or reduce your safety standards.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Ships using flags of convenience, I mean, we know they formed the template for the development of tax havenry itself. The ship that carried the explosives to Beirut and then sank is called the Rosas. And at first it looked like the owner was a Russian man living in Cyprus, but he seems to have just been a kind of agent with a history of acting as a corporate officer in companies run by other people. Here's Rana Sabag again.
Unfortunately, the sad thing is that, you know, there was this big hype. The government was the first to start that big hype about launching the investigation. Nothing has happened. Now they are basically, they have issued a statement through the Interpol, you know, wanting to talk to the owner of that vessel, who is not the original owner, as we have been able to prove.
Charalambos Manoli is a Cypriot shipping magnate. He denies he owned the Rosas, but OCCRP's investigations seem to show that he did own the ship through a company registered in the secretive jurisdiction of Panama. The ship itself was registered in Moldova, notorious for loose regulations for ships that aren't really seaworthy, among other things. The point of all this is the complexity. It really does make your head spin, doesn't it?
It does. And I think part of the challenge in wrapping your head around this is how we collectively come up with a kind of modern understanding of what a company is and what complex company structures are designed for. They are designed to create a beneficial ecosystem of businesses that trade with one another, that move liability to jurisdictions that benefit them. And of course, the extreme complexity that sits at the heart of it is the very outcome that people are designing these structures to achieve, because it is that complexity that makes it so hard to pin accountability to a person, to bring action, to seek justice.
Right, and there's another part of this which really jumped out at me, and that was the outsourcing aspect of this. So many governments around the world outsource the inspection of maritime vessels to private companies rather than the state performing those functions. And it's pretty horrifying that it appears in this case that the same person that seems to have owned the ship that wasn't really fit to sail seems to have also owned a firm conducting inspections of ships. So a clear conflict of interest there that wasn't evident, since he hid his ownership of both. That's really, really dangerous.
It is, absolutely. As you look across the world, what you see in public procurement, in a lot of kind of government practice, very, very basic due diligence just simply doesn't take place. You know, a lot of this information can be found, and it can be found, you know, at not insubstantive costs. And of course, we're campaigning for free, completely free, publicly accessible information about company ownership. But you have to use it, and you have to want to use it, and you have to do something with that information once you have it. You know, we've all, in this space, in the transparency and accountability space, become very used to the idea that, you know, transparency alone will not change anything. There has to be some action taken.
Yes, enforcement is often so weak, it's so underfunded around the world, it's not taken seriously enough by governments. That's an essential ingredient for change. Here's Rana Sabag again.
Unfortunately, your country and America is in many ways assisting this kind of corrupt behavior. This is like the worst realization that, you know, your country and the U.S. and all these offshores are providing all this secrecy and the ability to shield the beneficial ownerships and the structures of these companies. I mean, these people don't work alone, you know, it's part of a global network. So you have the attorneys that register these companies, you have the people that sell their names to the owners of these companies, and you have the jurisdictions that are protecting all the investments. Yeah. Every government is just looking at the amount of money this industry is creating. But as I said, you know, these people are not working in isolation. They are part of a global system of attorneys, of facilitators. In many instances, you have, you know, 1,000 people running like 100,000 companies. Wherever you look, it's the same people that keep popping up. And someone has to stop that. It's not me. It's not you. It's the countries that have the clout. And that's the first-class world, you know. This is what I can't tolerate anymore, the lies by these people that all day long are talking about free speech and the fight against corruption. But when you want to expose it, there's like total silence. This cannot continue. This cannot continue. When I look today at the Lebanese, you know, half of the population is living below the poverty line, and there's like people don't have food anymore. I have friends in the middle class, you know, their son, for example, does not want to grow up in Lebanon. He told his parents, why should these people pay the brunt of this? Lebanon, it's got an amazing landscape. It's got these beautiful restaurants. Imagine, this is a country that basically has provided expertise around the world. Wherever you look, there will be a Lebanese banker or a Lebanese lawyer or a Lebanese doctor. I mean, they're amazing people. This cannot continue. This cannot continue.
I don't know if Lebanese families will get the justice they deserve, either nationally or internationally. But one thing that should never stand in their way is the global system that lets people do things that endanger the lives and well-being of others while hiding who they are. Because secrecy kills. Nations everywhere must now create public registers of the real owners of companies, and they must properly fund their tax and law enforcement authorities to use that information. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.
Well, there you go. That's the November TaxCast. The program only comes out monthly, and I try to play it a couple times a month to let you know, to catch up on the progress the Tax Justice Network is having around the world, really. And I think it's interesting to keep up with that, because I think that's a big issue, having these what do you call these places, like the Cayman Islands and these places where the wealthy hide their money. I mean, some people call it properly a tax shelter, others call it tax dodging. So I'm real. We carried the tax cast from the Tax Justice Network for, my goodness, it must be going on 4 years. So I really appreciate it, and thank you, Naomi Fowler, the host, for allowing me to do so. Now we have a caller, and I haven't really screened the guy. I hope he's coherent. You know how it goes with callers. He sounded okay. Let's see. I'm going to put him on the air here if I can. At the computer.
Hello?
I think you're on the air, sir. Yes, you're on the air. My name's Mike. What would you like to go by?
Khalil.
Khalil, okay. All right. You have some commentary on the show, on the program that we broadcast, or anything? What would you like to talk about?
Well, one of the things I noticed that people, like with the healthcare thing, is like they would say that they had too much, it was like it cost too much and stuff like that. Those people, a lot of the people didn't want healthcare. But at the same time, when it came to actual, like, wasting money on stopping gay marriage, these same people didn't want it. They wanted it. And sometimes, like, the people that want to hide their wealth, I feel it might be the same thing. And because, matter of fact, I'm going to tell you, I went to this event, and Obama was saying Romney was calling Obamacare, and he said, Obama calls it Romney don't care. And I get some of that same feeling about some of these people that want to hide their wealth, because there's no need to hide your wealth, you know?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that when I'm talking about wealth, I'm talking about extraordinary amounts of wealth. I mean, I'm not talking about a married couple or a family that makes maybe $150,000, $200,000 a year. That's a lot of money.
Right.
Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But
right.
I think they're talking about people who move their money so quickly that even the tax authorities of different countries can't keep up with where the money's being moved to. You know, the problem is not just it's endemic. It's happening. It's been happening for decades all over the world. People hiding their extremely wealthy people hiding their wealth, and this is the only thing that I see. This is the only group, and I've studied it, watched this for years, that it seems to be doing anything about it. I mean, I don't see. I mean, they don't call Squeaky Joe Biden, Mr. Credit Card from Delaware, for nothing. They called him that when he was in the Senate. And it's sort of like with Donald Trump, it's sort of like having the fox guard the chicken coop when it comes to wealth, too, on himself. So I don't get into this party stuff, political party stuff. I really try to get to the base of it. I think in the green room,
well,
you mentioned something about law enforcement also and firefighters.
Yeah. Yeah, firefighters and police, because – oh, sorry. I hope I didn't cut you off.
No, you didn't. Go ahead.
I found out that firefighters later on in my life, because, see, I have autism. I also was really young when I found this out. I found out that firefighters and police get their work vehicles, their clothes, and their gear, like their guns, their walkie-talkies, the handcuffs, the battle axes, the hoses, the hats and like axes and all that stuff from the federal and state taxes, you know. And I said, if we don't have taxes, then how are we going to pay for this stuff?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And if people,
I noticed,
go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Can I say something before you talk, before you go on? I don't want to cut you off or anything like that.
No, go ahead. I'm trying not to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I watched these shows like In Plain Sight and stuff like there's another movie. It's called In the Line of Duty. It's about a militia, a guy that didn't want to pay taxes. And I noticed in a lot of those movies that the feds and the local detectives, they lay their jackets down sideways. They're not their personal jackets when they're on plain clothes, but they're nice jackets, and they're like their jackets when they're undercover plain clothes. They lay them sideways, and you can see the sleeve and you can see the pocket. And I just never knew that. I was just wondering if that was like a thing to keep it like neat and stuff, so or keep it like to where it didn't get torn or anything like that. Did you notice that?
No, I never really noticed that. What is this In Plain Sight? What is that about? Can you describe that? Is it a movie or a book or what?
It's a TV show that used to come on USA Network. It was about the government hiding witnesses for, like, when they had, like, crimes committed against them. Some of them were criminals. Some of them were cops. Some of them were just everyday citizens that were neither. Some of them were children. Some of them were families with animals. You know, some of them were different people. And the U.S. Marshals would, like, do that. And they had, like, some of them, they had basically, like, people posing as DCF and stuff like that, like other government workers that weren't police officers. But they actually were police officers. They were U.S. Marshals. And it was a good show.
Wow. Yeah, I never heard of it. There's a book out called In Plain Sight, I think. I haven't read it yet, but, well, that's interesting. Thanks for filling me in on that. The only thing I could say is I've had experience with the U.S. Marshals on a professional basis when I was a private detective, and that was one of their bailiwicks was the witness protection programs. I don't know much. They were always very good. I never ran into any of them that were really bad, but they were working Joe. They seem to be more working Joe and Jill than some of the FBI officers I've communicated with. So I always liked them. They were regular guys, you know what I mean? And I didn't see anything nefarious or some evil thing going on. They just seemed like regular guys, you know. I got a lot of respect for him, you know.
I've also watched Mississippi Burning, and the agents, the federal agents that were like, and see, I realized this too. I came up with this conclusion. They were talking about we don't come. You still there?
Yes, I'm still here. Go ahead.
They said, hello? We don't come to the North and tell you how to live your life. But I realized that the people, when you pay taxes, it goes to everywhere. It goes to the North, the South, the East, the West. So if you're paying taxes, you're paying federal taxes for everywhere. And I realized that if you're paying federal taxes for everywhere, you should have a say in how people are treated, you know. Plus, it's also a human rights thing. But I noticed that the FBI agents, when they would set their jackets in their chair, they would set them next to them. They wouldn't set them right on them, but they would set them next to them.
Yeah. Well, that's probably because they, speaking from experience, you know, it, dry cleaning is very expensive. And now, especially nowadays, so they probably didn't want to get their suit jackets all wrinkled because they have to wear them like work clothes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you notice it with like detectives. Sorry, you notice it with detectives and like FBI agents and U.S. Marshals how they put their jackets next to them.
I never really looked. I mean, you just said that how they put it on another chair. You know, that's just a grooming. It's just some sort of grooming habit you get stuck in when you have to wear nice clothes, business clothes, seven days a week. You know, sometimes if you're working a long stint, a lot of these people, I did myself, sometimes you had to put in 18-hour days, and you wear your clothes out. It's hard. You wear your work clothes are suits. And you wear them out. So you got to sort of take care of them on the run. Like I used to get in my car and I would take my suit coat off and hang it on the back of the driver's seat or I'd have a hanger. And some of these cars used to have these little clips on the back seat so you could put a clothes hanger in there and hang your suit coat. I just think it's a matter of. Like, you know, this is funny that we're talking about this, but I'm trying to answer your question. No, I've never really noticed how they lay their suit coats or what, but I know why. They're probably trying to make that suit coat last a few more days longer before it has to go to dry cleaning, because it's dry cleaning is very expensive. I'm sorry, but that's what I think. There you go.
Yeah, because I met this person that was this I was at the Obama rally, and she was very nice. I was a little nervous of her, and she basically was giving me directions to sit down, and she had something next to her. And before I sat down, she moved it real fast, and it clanked loud on the seat. And she was next to me, and she was writing down notes the whole time. And I was told she was an FBI agent.
Yeah. They shouldn't. I haven't ran into any law enforcement.
Yeah, I ran into one.
Who wear their guns on their suit coats. I mean, it's just like that's unheard of. That's very interesting that you brought that up. So you were talking about taxes. Well, you know, I've learned something late in life. I think you're on to something there about how taxes are distributed more, federal taxes are distributed more, I don't know, lack of better terms, uniformly around the country. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And I don't think a lot of people realize, like here in Kansas, the school districts, they have to meet certain criteria in the public schools. And they want to do that because they get a large amount of federal money for meeting those obligations, like taking care of crippled kids or my son had a speech impediment early on. When he was very young, now he doesn't have it, thanks to the teacher that helped him through that problem in his early days, you know, like second and third grade. And that was largely from the federal funds that were given to us. The state gives money to our school districts too, and we pay that through our state taxes. But, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think the uniformity of federal taxes is probably a good thing in terms of that. Now, the problem for me is I know people who have lots and lots of money, and they're not paying their fair share, in my opinion. They've got a lot of tax loopholes and deductions that, frankly, aren't available for the small business person or for especially the guy or gal who's out there working 8 hours a day, 60, 40 and 50 hours a week. I mean, they don't have those kind of tax breaks. So what do you think about that stuff?
That's not good when they don't pay their fair share. It's like really not good.
Yeah.
And some of them, they need to pay their fair share when they're working, or they need to have it taken out of their account. Taken out of their account, but like taken out of their paycheck wherever they're working.
Right. Right. Well, you know, so that,
like,
I'm just I think. Well, that, I don't know if you caught it. That part in the program that I just played, but a lot of these very wealthy people who hide their money in order to avoid paying taxes are helped by accountants. And there was a part in that program they were talking about holding the tax accountants, the people who are largely lawyers, excuse me, and CPAs, who will help the wealthy people hide their money through setting up nonprofit foundations, trust funds. They have a lot of dodges legal. They're absolutely legal. But the working guy, the working people, they don't have that kind of option. I think the world would be a lot better if these extremely wealthy people paid more than their share of taxes. I mean, I really do. I think that's the biggest problem that's bought in the world, other than, climate change. And it's sort of interesting where we're at right now in the world today. Don't you agree?
Yeah. And I found out the president has to pay taxes too.
Yeah, he does. A lot of, but they have they have a lot of the dodges. Like I'm not sure about this, but they, they have a. I don't know if you remember, Obama used to. One of the things I thought was good about Obama. Now there's a lot of things I didn't like his foreign policy. I don't like war, and he didn't really stop any of that stuff. He just changed it, but we kept doing it. But one thing the Obamas did do, I noticed, is they published their taxes, how much they paid, and how much taxes went to a charity. And we haven't got that with this with President Trump. I find that really disturbing. What does he got to hide? Why doesn't he just put it out? The IRS is auditing, but he hasn't done that. And it's not just to pick on Donald Trump. I mean, really. I mean, there's a lot of people like Donald Trump. A lot of people. I mean, there's 2,000. I think it's the number is 2,353 billionaires in the world right now, and these are multiple billionaires. These are not just one someone worth a billion. These are people who really got a lot of money, and a lot of them really operate, with these tax accountants, these lawyers, and CPAs. And that they have got, dozens, armies of lawyers to just keep them from having to pay taxes. Did you know what the tax rate was under President Eisenhower in the 1950s?
I'm not sure because I didn't live at that time.
Right. You sound, I don't mean to be mean or anything, but you sound young. I'm 65, and I barely remember this, but it's the truth. For the wealthiest people in the United States in the 1950s, they had a tax rate of 90%. That means if you made like more than $500,000 a year, the next dollar over $500,000, that dollar, the $500,001, that $1 they had to pay 90 cents out of in taxes. Now, if you were making, you can do the math, if you're making $1,000,000, you would still collect your $500,000, but the $500,000 above that would be taxed 90%. And I think that was much more fair. I think that's a good thing, and I wish we'd return to that. Because over the years, since Eisenhower, it's gotten down to like 28% or less, for these people who make a lot of money. So. It's been good talking to you.
I noticed that. Good talking
Khalif.
To you too.
How do you say your name again? Khalif?
Khalil. It's sort of similar to Khaled, but it's Khalil.
Khalil. Okay. Yeah. Khalil.
When you were a detective, did you? I don't know if you know this, but when you were a detective, were you private or you were public? Like, did you get federal tax dollars or were you private?
No.
I forgot.
No, I worked. I was a private detective, and I received a payment from the clients that I helped. But I did work because of the job. I had to work with a lot of law enforcement. So.
I was wondering, when they speak with the president, when they because I was told that the only people that can at presidential events and at concerts and stuff that can go into the crowd. That you can see one minute sitting down one place and then go into the crowd as a Secret Service and other police officers. I was told that the people like me, we can't do stuff like that. We can't go into the crowd after we sit down. We have to stay where we're seated.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it probably depends on what kind of a meeting it's going to be. I don't know. I went to a Bernie Sanders thing. I don't know, back at 4 years or 5 years ago, here in Lawrence, Kansas, and it was outrageous. I mean, we had to stand in line for 2 or 3 hours before we got in there. You walk through an airport type metal detector. Some guy, I think, was with the marshals or the Secret Service or somebody, some cop. Yeah, I didn't look that closely. Warned you about what you could take in and not take in. You couldn't take anything in, basically. But once you got into this place, you could I walked around, you know, walked through the crowd and around the crowd. There was no seating available. So I don't know. That's the closest I've ever come to some sort of some situation you're describing. I don't know, you know.
Because they were saying,
I don't know where.
They were saying that some of them were saying pins are prohibited when you go into presidential events. They don't want people having pins unless, like riding pins, unless they're a police officer or something like that.
Really? Huh. Well, no.
Because they said.
I've never heard that.
Because they said that they were trained, like, if a Secret Service agent saw someone with a pin and they were around the president, they were trained to knock it out their hands.
Well, sure, of course. I don't. Yeah, I mean, you probably should be very careful about what you. If you get that close to a president or a presidential candidate, you better be careful anyhow. I mean, look. Well, Khalil, it's
nice
been good talking to you. I'm running out of time.
All right.
I thanks for tuning in and listening to the TaxCast. We broadcast 5 days a week, and always feel free to call back in if you want. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Well, we're going to finish up the show today, and thanks for calling in. You know, it's really nice. It's one of the first callers we got that was reasonably civilized. that's a new one, you know, for me. So I hope you enjoy it. We'll be back on tomorrow. John Grant and I will be on tomorrow afternoon talking about movies. You know, John is an encyclopedia when it comes to movies, and we're going to try to jazz it up and talk about movies you can watch while you're in your plague bubble or you're in self-quarantine or whatever, these crazy times we live in. You know, we're going to try to readily accessible movies that you can check up on, and John Grant will tell you all about it, and I'll pitch in as much as I can. That begins at 1 o'clock Central Time here in Kansas tomorrow. So I hope you enjoyed the show today. Thank you for listening.